From the Carter Subaru Studios, this is Cairo Nights with Jake Skorheim.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. I am so excited that you guys are choosing to hang out with us here on this Friday night. It is the 9 o'clock hour. You could be doing a lot of other stuff right now, but you're choosing to hang out with us, and that means something to me. Honestly, I really do appreciate it. If you get a chance, check out the podcast. If you don't have a chance to listen to the first 2 hours of the show, if you've missed any of the first 2 hours, shame on you. The best way that you can make it up is to download the podcast, Cairo Nights with Jake Skorheim. You get it on Spotify, Apple, whatever. Lots of stuff to listen to there. So check it out. And now I'm really, really excited because we don't normally have the opportunity to have Felix Bonnell on the show, but we do today. Felix, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here.
So you texted me the other day, and I was so excited to get your text because on the show, I think it was maybe Wednesday night or Tuesday night.
That was Wednesday. I was driving down south, and you were talking about Ishtar, number one. That was the clue. I knew right away what you were talking about. Yeah, I knew right away you were talking about Ishtar because I had just been thinking about Ishtar a few days earlier.
Why? I'm going to pause you right there. Why in the heck were you thinking about Ishtar?
I'm a little bit older than you. I remember when that movie was made. I remember what an epic failure it was considered. I think was the total budget like $40 million.
It was a big deal at the time.
At the time, it seemed it was way over the top. And it was, you know, these bulletproof stars, Dustin Hoffman. Hoffman and
Hot
Warren
director.
Beatty, and it just all goes down in flames, and it's just it was like a punchline for most of the '80s, late '80s, and early '90s. This notion of it's like Ishtar,
and then thankfully for them, the movie kind of faded into obscurity, and nobody talked about it. But there are people like us who
becomes
know
a cult
the movie.
Favorite. Yeah,
becomes
comes
a cult
back.
Favorite.
Yeah, and I love that clip you played of the music, the song they're singing.
It had all the elements that should have made a great movie. I mean, like, it has everything except a horrible story.
Yeah, no lightning in a bottle, as they always say. But then I didn't catch the rest of the show, but I remember you teased your next segment, like, when we come back, we're going to talk about my favorite Twilight Zone episode. Oh, man, this show is aimed at my demographic. Like,
I know.
Weird guy who has a car radio still.
Weird guy at night.
Watched way too much TV as a child and maybe sometimes as an adult as well.
Way too much. Yeah, I watched way too much. But
I studied it. I studied television.
I studied television.
Yeah.
I wasn't just watching it. I was watching the way that stories broke down. I was watching the way that that storytellers would actually lay out a thing for you. And there's A stories and B stories and all the different things. I was paying attention to those things as a kid, and I loved it.
And for my family, I'm the youngest of nine kids. My mom was a total movie buff. She grew up in London in the 20s and 30s, where they would go to the movie multiple times a week to the cinema to watch films. So everyone in my family, before Wikipedia, knew the names of all the actors.
Yes.
I remember being a little kid, I don't know, 7, 8 years old, and everyone was like, oh, look, they wouldn't say, oh, it's that guy from, My Three Sons. They'd say, oh, here comes Fred McMurray, and they would everyone would know everyone's name.
Burgess Meredith, and everyone knew who it was.
That's what it was like. And I remember going to a friend's house, and they're watching a show, and it's like, nobody knew anything. And this was before Wikipedia, when you actually had to be Wikipedia.
Yes.
You had to know which show this person had been on before. You had to know their name. You had to know all the stuff. You had to keep it in your head. It was insane.
And to bring it back to Ishtar for just a half second, the reason I know that movie... There was a pride in knowing all about these obscure, crazy things.
Yes, exactly.
So on a TV show, we're about to talk about The Twilight Zone, or you look at Ishtar, something like Ishtar. Nobody knows what Ishtar is.
Yep.
And so
yep.
if you know it, I instantly know something about you.
It's a kinship, and it's a community, the invisible community that's formed by this kind of knowledge. I mean, that's still possible, even in the age of Wikipedia and everything. I mean, you can still have those sorts of moments with people and connect about esoteric pop culture, and that's what it's all
about. Like you and I are doing right now.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you texted me, and you're like, hey, we should do a deep dive into Twilight Zone. Because I think you understood from, when I was doing it on the show the other night, and it was just totally random, and that's the fun thing about when we do live radio and stuff. We had played a clip from Jack and Spike's show, and they were talking about how there's pleasure bots or sex bots or whatever it is with AI.
Yep.
And so then as I was listening to that clip on the news roundup, I was like, oh, this actually reminds me of a Twilight Zone episode, which happens to me five times a week, something I read about in the news. I remember as a theme in one of the episodes of Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, there's this crazy Twilight Zone episode where this guy, played by the actor Jack Warden, gets lost on a planet, and I think it's called The Lonely or something, and he gets sent to a planet because it's part of a prison sentence. It's like a prison planet.
That's right, yep.
He's sent to this planet, they drop him off, and the pilot of the ship that drops him off, because he's committed murder back on Earth, or he's been convicted of it at least, the pilot decides to take pity on this guy, and he leaves him this mysterious, woman-sized shaped box. And so the captain of the spaceship takes off, and then the guy is kind of rooting around trying to figure out what he's going to do now on this distant planet where he's been sent to, and he opens this box, and it is a female robot.
Nice.
But she looks exactly like a real female. And so he's there for 11 months, and then, as always happens in the Twilight Zone, there's an ironic twist to the end. And so at the end of the episode, they come back and they go, hey, great news. You are actually like 11 months, only 11 months has gone by. It's still a long time to be isolated. But the guy, the captain comes back and he says, hey, really great news. We're here to get you. You're not going to have to be stuck here for 50 years. You're coming home, because they realize that you have been wrongly convicted and they threw your case out. You're a free man. Come home with us. And he goes, oh my gosh, it's so great. I'm so excited to come home. But he has now fallen in love with this robot. Yep. And they don't have enough weight on the spacecraft to take it, the robot home. And so now he's having to choose, like, did I really love this robot, or is it just something else? And so the captain, and viciously, the captain goes over with his like futuristic laser gun or whatever he's got, and he shoots her in the face.
Oh, man.
And when he shoots her in the face, you know, and we've come to know her as like, yeah, she kind of seems like a woman, you know, yeah. A little Stepford wifey, but kind of seems real. And he shoots her in the face, and then her face has underneath all these wires, exposed wires. And, and then the guy kind of snaps out of it, and he realizes, I've got to remember, she was just fake. You know, it was just my own feelings. But it was just, I love that show. Yeah, I love the Twilight Zone so much.
They're indelible. I mean, you could see, I watch those episodes a lot. I mean, I was thinking of earlier today, you know, there's so much cable TV and streaming now. When I was a kid, there was the three network stations. There was KCTS9, Channel 11, KSTW. So we had five stations,
yeah.
Right? Or is that six? I guess six stations. No, five. And the ratio of good content to bad content was pretty high, because you could see all these great old reruns from the 1950s and 1960s.
Oh, you're right.
You didn't have
yeah.
to sift through 300
it
channels.
It was just the things that like...
It was actually, in retrospect, yes. We actually had it pretty good, even though you couldn't pick the time that you watched stuff. Or if you missed it, you missed it. Or if you didn't read in the paper that it was coming up. But you would turn on the TV. I think the Twilight Zone was on Saturday afternoons. You turn it on, not even knowing what the episode was going to be. You just knew it was going to be good. And it usually was.
It was always good.
And if you watched enough, you'd see repetition, or you'd have, like, my older siblings. So my older brother, Richard, is really into the show, too. He kind of introduced me to it. And he just sort of becomes this thing where I don't think we even knew how much it had permeated the pop culture yet, because there wasn't this ability to share this excitement about pop culture the way there is now on social media. But it just was out there for the last 60 years of the show, since it went off the air.
Yeah.
Just still seeping its way, and still, it's still a thing that people recognize this many years later, because the stories are so... Most of them are so brilliantly written and so elemental
brilliant.
And so easy to explain. And they often have those twists to them.
What's interesting, so the show originally ran from 1959 to 1964,
yep.
which is not like a super long run.
No, it's respectable. It had decent ratings, not crazy ratings, and it was expensive. You know, a lot of the productions were, you know, one-of-a-kind props and bizarre sets and like remote places where they shot it and stuff. So it wasn't like a big moneymaker.
So this is what everybody remembers. This is the, I mean, like it had this, one of the best theme songs of all times.
Probably
one of the most recognizable still to this day.
The melody, yeah.
Even though the show has been off the air. Think about this. The show has been off the air this year for 60 years.
We're still talking about it. We've got to get some new topics for the show,
isn't
obviously.
That crazy, yeah. though? But it is one of those touchstone shows. You and I were texting each other when we were talking about doing this. It's one of those things, and you mentioned this, that you can talk about, like if somebody's a fan of The Twilight Zone, there's nobody who's like just kind of a fan. They either really know the show or they don't really know it at all.
Yep.
And so for the people that know it, they really love it. And you can talk about specific episodes. And this was a point that you were making. It's not just like, oh, the general theme of the show or the feeling of the show. It was this specific episode I really, really love, because they were all their own individual little stories.
Yeah, and oftentimes you know the title of the episode. Now, a lot of TV series, I've learned many years later when you go to Wikipedia, that episodes of Leave It to Beaver had a title. Or episodes of Andy Griffith had a title. Those titles were never discussed on air. They're never seen in the credits. With Twilight Zone, the title is seen in the credits, and it became a shorthand. The one you talk about, like, oh, Terror at 10,000 Feet, you know, the one with William Shatner seeing the thing out on the wing. Or the one that I think that is probably the most indelible for me, which I guess we'll talk about, is that one called To Serve Man.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is the title of the book as well. Anyway, there's no other show I can think of. I think maybe the first Star Trek might be like this, too. There might be titles for those episodes.
Sure.
But you actually talk about, not by saying, hey, the one where Andy goes and, you know, Barney Fife drives the car off a cliff.
Yeah.
You actually know. You say the title of the show, and people know what you're talking about. That's unusual. That's where TV sort of becomes literature rather than just 30 minutes with commercials in between the good parts.
And here is the opening theme song, that everybody totally recognizes.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination, Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
I love that old CBS, like...
production logo.
Production value. Yeah. I love the old... I mean, all the instrumental stuff there is just so perfect, and it just makes you feel what the 1950s, 60s would have felt. Like, I love the sounds that they had back then.
I think at the end of the show, it says, like, it's a Cayuga production or something, and there's a thing that goes, dun, 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 dun.
Yeah, it's a real, there's like it's, real showmanship
to it. It's literature. It's highbrow. But it's, you know, it's on a middle brow medium of television, but it's this really highbrow. Rod Serling aimed really high. I mean, he had really, his values are really formed by his time in World War II and the death and destruction he witnessed.
Yes.
And all the stuff that he wrestled with is this very intense guy. He's only 5 feet, 4 inches tall.
I was going to say, I looked into him a little bit. I want to tell you some stuff about him that I found out. And I didn't know a ton about his history.
Yeah.
But I found a clip, actually. I'm going to play a quick clip of him. He gave an interview in 1970. This is well after the show went off the air, but he had become kind of a, you know, people looked at him as like, oh, this guy's a kind of a genius. And they were asking him why he likes modern science fiction. What's funny is like the science fiction on Twilight Zone is so timeless, even though at the time it was like, you know, dealing with, they were modern day stories. So oftentimes it would be like set in a town at that time, you know, like in 1950 something, and you're, you know, it's not super far off in the future, and that was by design. But even though he said it in the 1950s, you can watch those same episodes today, and they seem super relevant to our time right now. But anyway, he was asked why he doesn't focus on science fiction, which was really popular at the time. Science fiction would be like, all right, what's it going to look like in the year 3000?
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Or outer space. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he says, I really like to keep it close to home.
If I had a group of stories to select, I think by virtue of its mass media form, I would try to choose those stories that, though even science fiction and genre, would be tellable in terms of the most acceptable human terms that we now know. I would probably shy away from the year 2500. I would much rather deal in 1998. The hardware that I use, I think, should be identifiable. Different, of course, because it changes every year. But I would be more prone to think in terms of, I'd like to know what happens Thursday, not in the next century.
Isn't that so great? And it's this kind of this like approachable sci-fi that I think made that show really work, because it was something that the average family, it was a family show. It was something that somebody could sit down, they could enjoy it with their wife. You could also sit down and watch it with your kids. You'd all get something different out of it.
Yeah, it's recognizable. It's like the best science fiction. It isn't just about like robots fighting each other in some distant galaxy or whatever.
Yeah.
It's about just, it's holding up a mirror to stuff that looks pretty normal.
Yes.
And adding some bizarre twist or some bizarre element of technology that isn't here yet, but that might be here someday. And just, it's like Shakespearean. I mean, like the plots stand up so well because they're so elemental and they're so universal and just so well done, so brilliantly written. He got his start in writing radio drama, which isn't surprising, which is you have to write really tightly for radio drama and everything.
Right.
And he mentions that in some stuff I read about him, that it's like that's where he got his writing chops, is writing stuff for radio.
I was looking into him a little bit because I was really fascinated, like the mind of somebody who could come up with this stuff. I mean, he wrote many of the episodes of Twilight Zone.
Yep, like I think 2/3 of them or something like that, just cranked it out at just a crazy pace.
When you think about the ideas that he was coming up with, and which have now been, you know, I mean, you could take one of the plots of Twilight Zone and you can stretch it out and make it into a movie today.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, like 10-episode Netflix series.
Yeah, so many of those episodes are so condensed and they're so packed with things.
Yep.
And his brain, the way he worked. And so I was looking into, okay, like how did that come about? So in 1942, Rod Serling, he's 18 years old. He volunteers for the war. The day after he graduates high school, he also turns 18. So he can officially volunteer. So he volunteers, he becomes a paratrooper. The paratroopers are the ones that kind of go in ahead of the rest of the armed forces. Yep. And so he has these really, really dark experiences, apparently, as a paratrooper. Yep. He loses a bunch of his friends. Some of their deaths were like quite ironic. And one of his biographers actually detailed, I pulled this clip here. One of his biographers talks about one of his buddies in war died in this really ironic way.
I think I know what this is about.
and then later you see this in his own writing, like when he starts writing for other things, like especially in all of the Twilight Zone episodes, they're marked by like massive amounts of irony.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, listen to this real fast. This is one of his biographers.
He gave each of these characters an ironic death.
Oh, this is...
Are you playing the banjo in the background on this?
I'm not. This is for the video. I apologize. But he's talking about... So he comes home from the war. He's had this kind of like very PTSD experience. Yep. He's lost a bunch of his friends. He also was injured. He got like hit with some shrapnel. So he like dealt with that for the rest of his life. But after the war, he enrolls in college. And then he decides he wants to take this creative writing class because he has this like writing bug that he wants to itch. And so he does that. And one of his first assignments is, you know, write a story, write a creative story. So what he decides to do is he writes about his experience in as a paratrooper and losing all these friends. And each chapter of this story that he wrote dealt with a different ironic way that one of his friends in war actually died. Wow. And you think about like a 22-year-old. Who's in college, who has just, you know, been a part of the greatest generation, who saves the world, coming back and trying to figure out, like, how do I rationalize everything that I've just experienced?
Oh, yeah, and there's very few mechanisms in place to process that kind of trauma.
Especially
that
back in 1945. No,
exactly. And it's like, and it's the most brutal aspects of humanity he's witnessed day after day.
Yes.
Of those different ways his buddies died, but just being part of the war in the first place and wanting to go fight overseas and, you know, joining up right after high school and everything. But yeah, there's very little in the way of mental health counseling. It's all very stigmatized at that point. And he's a sensitive guy, too. So he's not just some tough guy who's been out there killing people. He's this sensitive writer guy who witnessed all this stuff and has no way to process other than by writing story.
And like you were mentioning, he wasn't like a big giant man who was, you know, could have just like commanded his presence. So he sees the world as kind of a smaller guy. He was 5'4" tall. Yep. When he joined the paratroopers, he was 118 pounds. I mean, this is a smallish guy. Yeah. So that's the way that he sees the world. But he's got this, you know, this wonderful, powerful imagination. Incredible. Anyway, his biographer talks about this first assignment he had in college.
He gave each of these characters an ironic death. The famous one that a lot of people have heard of is a good friend of Serling's, Melvin Levy. When they were in the mountains of Leyte, and they were literally starving. I mean, they had gone 10 days without food, and it was raining continuously, and the planes were trying to find them to drop supplies, to drop food and ammo and everything else. And finally, the planes got through, and Melvin Levy was out there waiting for the planes, and a crate fell out, you know, was dropped from the plane and landed on Melvin Levy and killed him instantly. And, you know, you don't get any more ironic than that, a starving soldier being killed by a crate of food. And that sense of irony is what he carried right into the Twilight Zone with the twist endings and what have you. So that it's hard not to trace it back to those experiences.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, that really was what the Twilight Zone was about. It was about holding a mirror up and somebody looking at it and going like, oh, wow, like this is, you know, they were all, many of them had ironic endings. But it was also about very effectively commenting on what was happening in the time. So much of it was about, you know, dictatorship and war and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and then, you know, the atomic age brought in right at the end of World War II that creates all this other sort of uncertainty about what's really going to be a year ahead, 5 years ahead, 10 years ahead, whether we'll have this brilliant future to imagine or whether we'll, you know, the future we can imagine is simply survival.
Yeah.
It all fuels in, and he timed his career pretty well to be the perfect guy to do that anthology series and starting in 1959.
All right. When we come, but we've actually run out of the segment for first segment. We're done. We got to take a quick commercial break. But when we get back, now we can actually get into some of those segments. And we got a bunch of fun sound. And you and I have a bunch of these we want to throw at each other and see if we remember them, which I hope we will. All right. We got a lot more coming up. Stick around. We're going to be right back here with Felix Bunnell on Cairo Nights.
You're listening to Cairo Nights with Jake Skorheim.
All right, welcome back to Cairo Nights. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. I got Felix Bunnell with me right now, and we are talking about this ridiculous topic, but it's Friday night. We both love Twilight Zone so much, and so we decided, why don't we spend an hour talking about Twilight Zone? And so that's what we're going to do. We just gave you.
Will there be a twist ending of this hour? We'll get to the end of the hour and it'll be like warrior. Everyone will just like, be blown away. Like
look right at the audience.
I wasn't
somehow
expecting that to happen.
Yeah. Or we're describing everything that's happening in their life.
This episode, or you'll shoot a robot.
This episode is just for you, Kevin. There's a Kevin out there.
Wait, I'm not having the episode. This isn't Jake's show. This is somebody else's show who's having a dream.
Isn't this weird? Is this life? Is this real? All right, let's get into some of the episodes. You mentioned earlier one of the episodes, To Serve Man.
That's got to be in my top three as the most brilliant twist ending and just the most brilliant use of language to pile on a big trick right at the end. But you can watch it again and again, and you're still you're still blown away by the surprise ending, right?
What is the name of the actor? I'm trying to remember the name of the actor. He played Jaws in the James Bond movies.
Oh, it's Richard
something.
Oh, shoot.
Oh my gosh.
I have to look
at
you. Distract your listeners.
If there was only some way that we could possibly look up and find out the name of these guys. You know what I'm going to go to the library and I'm going to find a book on old James Bond movies.
Yeah.
And I'm going to see if I can find out what the name of Jaws was from the original James
Bond
movies.
I think his name might have been gone. Tip of my tongue. It's Richard Kiel.
Richard Kiel. Okay.
Yep.
So nobody in the audience really cares about that. You and I do care about that, though. So Richard Kiel plays this big, giant...
Well, a bunch of spaceships are seen. It's the present day in America.
Give us the
present day in America, which is Cold War. So it's scary. We're thinking the Soviets are going to destroy us. We might think, you know, we're worried about UFOs and aliens. All of a sudden, all these ships start landing all over the place. We see lights in the sky.
Are worried. Are these invaders?
They think it's some alien invasion. They're terrified about it. So, but then the leader of the aliens is this big, tall Richard Kiel, who has a giant head, like a big, glowing, weird, misshapen head. That kind of he doesn't make audible sounds.
No,
but he kind of his eyes move around and his head seems sort of pulsating.
And he communicates telepathically. So we can hear his voice. There's a voiceover effect. We can hear it.
We're privy to what's going on. Exactly. Yeah. And he's got in his arm. He's got this big book, like a giant piece of scripture or some huge volume in his hand that has some writing on the front of it. It's some weird alien language they don't know.
It's like Rosetta Stone. We don't know what's on it. And, you know, it has to be deciphered.
And pretty soon they figure out that the book is called To Serve Man. Oh, great. And then they start arranging for people on Earth to travel to this guy's home planet, like by the hundreds of thousands, getting on spaceships and flying to this planet.
Because
he's going to serve man. Man's going to be served by this odd being who's come from outer space, who's going to be in a James Bond movie someday, but we don't know that yet. And everything's going great through the episode, right? And there's a couple main characters who have kind of little smaller plots within this. As that main character is on the little gangplank to get on the spaceship.
I have that ending.
Someone
here.
Comes. Oh, you do? Oh, this,
yeah,
let's,
do you
let's
play?
Yeah, go here.
All right. Another thing you should know about this, too, is you know the movie, what's that movie with Amy Adams? Just came out a couple years ago.
Arrival.
So Arrival, you could argue, takes a massive page out of this storyline.
Absolutely. Story I remember that. Exactly. Yeah, no, I remember thinking the same thing watching that movie. Yep.
So you have a linguist in this Twilight Zone episode, To Serve Man. You have these two characters, and I think they're at like maybe a university or something, and it's a man and a woman. You can tell maybe there's a little something going on between them. And so the man and the woman are both trying to figure out, all right, how do we decipher this book? So that we can figure out how to speak the language of these people, of these aliens that we've really come to know and appreciate. We want to be respectful of them. They're like going to make life so great for us. And we want to be able to like return the favor so they don't just have to talk telepathically. Wouldn't it be great if we can learn their language? Also for like, I don't know, there's some mystery to it. Like, wouldn't it be great if we can crack this? So the guy.
But we know the title of the book. We know the title is called To Serve Man.
Yeah. Yeah. So the guy goes and he decides his number is up and he's called. And now he gets to go to the magical planet somewhere and he gets to go and live whatever in Shangri-La. And he's all excited and he's waiting online and he's about to climb up into the alien spaceship. And then his love interest during the story, it might be his love interest if I remember. I'm not sure.
I think so. Yeah.
But she runs up and she gets to the gates and then she has this message.
This is flight number 914 from Earth to our planet. We will be taking off in 3 minutes.
Mr. Chambers! Mr. Chambers! Don't get on that ship! The rest of the book, To Serve Man, it's a cookbook!
And they force him up out of the ship. They force him. So he's forced on the ship, and it's a cookbook. Yeah, they're going
to
eat him.
To Serve Man. It's such a cheap, bad joke, really, if you think about it. To Serve Man is a cookbook. But it's so brilliantly executed by the
It's
by
only
the
a joke now, 60 years later. At the time, nobody had done it, really.
Yeah, that's true.
Everything had been done before, I'm sure, at some point. But it was like, what a great twist ending.
It was brilliant, yeah.
Fantastic twist ending. And then there's like a little bit of there's a little bit more after that. We didn't get it, but he's on the spaceship and the big Jaws guy comes in and he's squeezing his arm. He's like, "Now, Mr. Something, make sure you're eating. We wouldn't want you to lose any weight now." And now we all know they're just fattening them up. So then go and eat them. This was another one. This is another one that jumped out at me, and this one scared the heck out of me when I was a kid. That was the other thing. I could watch these with my family, and they were fun for my parents to watch. We watched a ton of old stuff when I was a kid. We could watch these as a family, and I was legitimately, genuinely freaked out.
Yep. Yep, because they're not gory, they're not grisly, they're nothing visually scary, but they just plant a seed in your mind, and you think about it. You lay there in your bed as a little kid worrying about it.
Okay, so speaking as a little kid, this one's the name of this episode is "It's a Good Life." Ah. Okay, so in this episode, you have this strange scenario. You don't really know what's going on. You're kind of like being kept a little bit in the dark.
Yep.
And they start piecemealing it out to you a little bit at a time. And you're inside a house. You're in what looks like, you know, rural Ohio, kind of in farm country or something. And you have all of the adults in this world seem to be walking on eggshells, like really walking on eggshells. And they're really nervous. And you have this adorable little six-year-old kid, this little child actor. And I mean, we don't know his child. He's an actor.
It's Billy Mummy, right? Isn't it Billy Mummy?
I believe so. Yeah, I think you're right. So you have a six-year-old kid, and he's kind of walking around. His name is Anthony. Everybody's really paying attention to what Anthony wants and basically does anything that Anthony wants. And as you watch the episode, you start to realize that Anthony has some sort of a magical power that he was born with. And it's not really ever explained. It's just this idea that this little kid, with the whims of a child, can do whatever he wants. And wouldn't that be a terrible world to live in if you have this little child who can do whatever they want? And it's kind of analogous to any dictator in history.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so whether it's the Soviets or whatever, especially in that era, it's like Khrushchev or somebody. Probably.
Yeah. Yes. And so, and you know, obviously Rod Serling was instrumental in, fighting Hitler. So he understood the dangers of dictators and societies where only one people get to be in power. And so you have this very simple story about a little kid. So there's, and the scene actually, the episode has great acting. Listen to this. This is one of the characters is finally, it's his birthday. He's one of the adults. It's his birthday. And he just wants them to sing happy birthday to him. But the kid doesn't want a happy birthday song. But this guy wants a happy birthday song. And the acting, when you're watching this as a kid, you're just like, oh my gosh, this is like, there's a real danger here.
Don't play that, Pat. That's not what I want you to play. Play this. Happy birthday to me. Happy birthday to me. Happy birthday.
Please stop.
Danny.
Please,
happy
please
birthday
stop.
Play it, Pat. Play it so I can sing right. You know I can't carry a tune unless somebody plays it.
And as it's happening, this little 6-year-old kid is just kind of staring at him, almost looking like what's his face in The Shining. You know that look in The Shining.
Yeah.
It's very freaky. I'm gonna play for you when we get back. I'm gonna play for you what happens to that guy. If you haven't seen the episode, you don't want to miss it. But if you have seen it 60 years ago, you'll still like it. All right, we're gonna be right back here with Felix Bonnell on Cairo Nights.
You're listening to Cairo Nights with Jake Skorheim.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. All right, we are discussing, this is crazy, but we're discussing Twilight Zone. So it's been off the air for 60 years, whatever. We still like it. We want to talk about it. So I got Felix Bonnell in here. He's an equal lover of Twilight Zone. Felix, welcome back to the show.
Of course.
All right, so before the break, we were playing you a clip from one of the famous episodes called It's a Good Life. It's about a little kid who's got some magical powers, and he can send people to the cornfield. It's really, really, really creepy. And we were just about to get to the point where he makes a man disappear. And as a kid, this scared the living heck out of me. And it stuck with me to an adult.
You dirty little monster. You murderer.
This is an adult. Again, this is an adult actor talking to one of the most cherubic-looking six-year-olds in TV history. And he's saying these horrible things because this kid is kind of a monster. And he's got them all stuck there. They can't do anything about it because he's like, wish them away to some magical place. And he can do with them whatever he wants. And so one of these adults kind of has this breakdown. And he's like, you'll hear what he tries to get the other adults to do.
You think about me. Go ahead, Anthony. You think bad thoughts about me. And maybe some man in this room, some man with guts, somebody who's so sick to death of living in this kind of place and willing to take a chance, will sneak up behind you and lay something heavy across your skull and end this once and for all.
You're a bad man. You're a very bad man.
Go ahead, Anthony. I'm a very bad man. Keep thinking that. Somebody sneak up behind him. Somebody.
somebody end this now while he's thinking about me? Won't somebody take a lamp or a bottle or something and end this?
You're a bad man. You're a very bad man. And you keep thinking bad thoughts about me.
Just turn him into a Jack in the Box.
Wish it into the cornfield. Please, son, wish it into the cornfield, please.
And the subtext to every one of these episodes, it's always about something. So that's what it feels like to live under a dictatorship.
Yeah, and a little bit of McCarthyism in thrown in there too, probably. Yeah.
Won't somebody stand up and do something? Why are we all letting this happen in front of our faces? But nobody does.
And if one person stands up, that person gets smacked down if nobody else comes to their
aid. And all you need is a second person to be there. And if like enough of them as a group, then they wouldn't have to live in this horror anymore. But they
absolutely. It's like Putin and Navalny kind of thing right there.
So let's get into really fast. We only have a couple minutes left. Round. Let's talk about your favorite episodes.
I think it's about people who don't realize they're dead or have some weird premonition of their death. And my favorite example of that is called Ring-a-Ding Girl. It's about this actress who's in Hollywood. She's famous. She's got to go to Europe to film a movie, but she gets a letter from her hometown fan club with some kind of a ring in it. And she looks at the ring and she sees some kind of an image of her sister or something. Back at her hometown, they're planning the big annual picnic in the town. Bunny shows up. This actress, her name is Bunny. She shows up and she's going to put on a show in the theater the same time the picnic's going on. So it's kind of like the competition for the picnic. And the people, the organizers of the picnic don't get like, why are you ruining our picnic by having everyone's going to go to your show at the theater. Everyone's all confused. She does it. Everyone goes to the show. There's a rainstorm and a plane crashes at the time at the picnic grounds while the show's going on. And Bunny's on that plane and dies in the plane crash.
Wait,
so she's giving a show at the town hall at the big theater.
I don't remember this one.
And everyone's attracted to it. So no one's killed when the plane crashes, where if they'd gone to the picnic, they all would have died in the plane crash on the ground. But she saved them by coming back as a ghost or someone who wasn't dead yet. Like there was a version of Bunny on the plane flying to Europe. There was a version putting on a show in the town theater to get people to not go to the picnic. So then when her plane crashed, and then they can't find her. She's disappeared. She's gone, of course, because her body's in the wreckage of the plane.
Isn't that amazing, like, that they could pull off something like that in the 1950s? That might have been early 60s at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably second, third season.
Yep.
That's a very complicated idea.
It's incredibly complicated, and it's incredibly spooky, because it makes you wonder, like, God, what is afterlife? Or thoughts you have, or, like, people doing things, or why people act bizarrely. What's really going on? Is that really them? That's stuff that just, it's indelible. It just sticks with you. I haven't seen that episode for probably 25 years.
What's
I saw it on broadcast.
Do you remember
Ring-a-Ding Girl.
Ring-a-Ding Girl.
Yeah,
love that.
No one really famous in the cast as far as I can remember, but it's like that show called The Hitchhiker, which was a radio show in the 40s they did a version of on The Twilight Zone, where this woman's driving cross country. She keeps seeing this hitchhiker trying to get into her car. She's kind of scared of him. She doesn't realize she died in a car wreck like hundreds of miles back.
Oh, no. So he's like the Grim Reaper or something.
Exactly. She doesn't know she's dead.
Yeah.
There's got to be a dozen Twilight Zone episodes where the main character doesn't know they're dead.
Which is like Sixth Sense. Like Sixth Sense, 50 years later.
Same kind of thing.
Uses that same exact plot. Becomes a massively super famous hit movie. One of mine, you mentioned this earlier, one of mine that I just loved. Scared the heck out of me as a kid. It's basically like Jaws in the air for me. Nightmare at 20,000 feet. William Shatner sitting there on the plane, and he looks out, and I'm like, I'm kind of a nervous flyer myself, but he looks out the window, and and it's raining and storming, and he sees, by today's standards, like a very silly costumed something.
Kind of a spooky, creepy face.
Got a spooky, creepy face, and I was watching clips of it like as we were preparing to do this show tonight. It still has that. I still get a chill when I watch that.
I'm feeling the tingle of the back of my neck just thinking about it now. It's like a grim, and no one else sees it. No one believes him. Every time he calls someone over to the window.
Yes.
And he's just gotten out of a mental hospital. He's sort of like very fragile and trying to fly home and kind of restart his life.
So
his wife is there with
crazy.
Him. They think he's losing it again. And every time he looks out, then the scariest scene is when he opens a curtain and the face is pressed right against the glass.
Yes.
That's just like, that's like the most basic of horror movie technique right there, like the scary reveal. It's
but that
brilliant.
Is 60 years ago.
Uh-huh.
I mean, like this guy is inventing, Rod Serling, is inventing all these things, and then they just become like, this is totally industry standard now that somebody was just like, oh, just, you know, such a fantastic show. I wish we had more time to talk about this. I can't even believe we're already out of time. Felix Bunnell, I love that you love Twilight Zone as much as me.
Same here. Let's do this again sometime. Let's pick some other TV show. Let's do our favorite Gilligan's Island episode.
There you go. I don't know if that
with,
would be...
The ones with twist endings where they don't get rescued at the end.
But I could. But I could because I watched Nick at Night like crazy as a kid. All right, that's Felix Bunnell. That's the end of our show. I hope you guys had a good time tonight. We had a blast bringing it to you. Have a wonderful weekend. Have some fun celebrating St. Patrick's Day. And we're going to see you back here next week. But for now, we got to get out of here. It's late. I'm tired. Night-night.
It was all just a dream.